Hi, I'm Skip Nipper. Welcome to my podcast, where I tell you about Nashville's great baseball history and traditions.
Shot to right, a one-hop liner.
Certainly about its past, especially about Tom Wilson Park, Herschel Greer Stadium, Sulphur Dell, but also a little bit about its present and future, too.
Yes, he can. It makes the waist-high catch.
And I introduce you to players, coaches, and other fans and their love for everything baseball.
A high fly ball down the right field corner going way back, hits a leadoff home run.
My podcast guest today is someone I have admired for a long time. Never really spent much time with him, but I know who he is because in 2012, he took Goodlettsville Little League all the way to the finals of the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and they won the United States Championship. So I hope you'll enjoy listening to my conversation with Joey Hale. Tell me about you, about yourself, and what you do, and you're growing up, and your family, would you?
I mean, you know, I grew up playing ball at Parkwood, you know, for my dad. He coached there from, I think, 1972, 73 through 83, 84. And then he kind of retired from coaching for a while until my nephew came of age in Stones River. But, yeah, you know, my entire childhood is based around baseball. You know, Dad coached pretty much Parkwood All-Stars and state tournaments and Dixie World Series pretty much every year, you know, 74, 75, 77, 78, 79, 80, and 82. And Parkwood and won the Dixie World Series 78, 79, and 82. Then he came back and coached Stones River and my nephew Seth in 1996 and won the Dixie World Series again for the fourth time. So, yeah, I kind of grew up with baseball, following his teams around, work for the fire department now, been there for, like I said, a few years, but it seems like the more years you've been on, it used to be a badge of honor. Now it's like, golly, it just means you're old. So I don't even say how many years I've been on, but it's a few. You know, I do that and coach baseball is pretty much it. You know, I feel fortunate I still have a father like mine who has given me, that's part of what I inherited from him, was the passion to coach. And, you know, my son's already come through the league. He hasn't been in the league in many years. He's already an adult now, and I'm still there. And I just love it, you know, and I know it came from him. I honestly believe I coached pretty much to honor him and what he's done for me because, I always say I'm the coach I am, or I've had success as a coach because of him, because he was always there, kind of like, you know, the guy standing behind you with his hands on your shoulder, guiding you in the right direction and telling you what you need to focus on, what you don't, what's important, what isn't, that type of thing. So I've been fortunate to have a little bit of success. I attribute a lot of it to his leadership and his guidance, I guess, helping me out.
Well, your service as a fireman can't be unrecognized. We have to thank you for that because that's a service that you lay your life on the line. And then you've developed this baseball career for what it is. I think you're well known and I think people appreciate what you have done. I'm sure there are players and parents who would tell you right now, thank you for what you taught them and would continue to do. You've already answered one of my questions I had, how important was your dad and your love for baseball? And you've already explained that. And I think that's great.
Yeah.
And his career at Parkwood, and then how did he get to Goodlettsville?
Well, like I said, Rip Ryman had a huge role in that. Rip was the state director for Dixie Youth for many, many, many years. My dad was coaching at Parkwood. Rip had grandkids, Daniel and Christopher. They were playing ball in Goodlettsville as five-year-olds, and Rip was the coach. And, of course, he and Dad stayed in contact for many, many years, and Miles is the same age as Daniel and Christopher. So he was like, why don't you get Miles to come and play? And like I said, at the time, Miles was going to Country Hills Golf Course and playing golf with Dad once or twice a week, learning how to play golf as a 5- and 6-year-old. And but we had asked him if he wanted to play. He kept saying no, he didn't want to play. And then the day before the final day of signups, he decided he wanted to. So we took him down to the Goodlettsville Community Center, signed him up, and he played for Rip his 6-year-old year, which was his first year playing ball. And then he played again for him as 7 and 8s. And that's where I got my start. You know, I told Rip that before he passed away, that he's the reason that I'm in Goodlettsville, because he asked my son to play ball through my dad And then when Miles got on his team, he asked me to help him, and I'd never coached in my life except for scouting teams from my dad's all-star teams in the past. But actually being on the field with kids, I'd never done it before. So coaching six-year-old kids was my first experience with Rip, and I stayed with him through 7 and 8. And then Dad took a team in Gillisville when my son was 9 and 10, and I helped him. And then after my son aged out and went to 11, 12, I stayed in the 9 and 10s and took my first team. And I've been at the park ever since. But yeah, right before Rip passed away, I remember telling him that. I said, you know, you're the reason, you know, that we're here, and thank you.
Yeah. Let me share a little personal experience I had with Rip. We were old timers members together. He was a secretary treasurer for a long time, but he was also the chairman of the scholarship committee. One of the great things that we do is raise money in the form of scholarships. And he was also instrumental in finding the places for us to go after we left the Max Labs. The place we ended up in, the old Marriott, which is the next step of the airport. We've had successful old timers banquets there. We just finished our 86th a few weeks ago. So Rip was a great friend, and meeting with him in his home and discussing scholarships and going through the applications, he influenced me so that after he passed away, before he passed, he wanted me to take all the literature. He knew his time was short. And I said, Rip, I'm going to do it for 2 years. And after that, I won't do it because I can't continue your legacy. And I'm going to tell you, his legacy with old timers is similar. Well, I can't say that it's better than the one at Gillisville Little League or at Parkwood in Gillisville, but certainly you have the respect for him that I had for him as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's a major influence in baseball in this city.
Yeah, he sure was.
Many years.
Good years. I've told my wife on many occasions that I have met so many people just through a love for baseball or connection that you make with someone.
Yeah.
I'll include you in that. And Rip, over the years, there are never any losses there. They're all gains. And I'm grateful. I just met so many that I count as a friend. All right. Now I'm going to skip up to 2012 because that was an exciting year for you, right?
Yeah, sure was. That was our second year in Little League. And, you know, we were Dixie Youth. Gillisville was Dixie Youth for a long, long time. And, you know, they were Dixie Youth back when Dad had his run at Parkwood, and they always met the sub-district for district. And you know, Gillisville always stayed with it, and they just steadily got better and got better and got better. And had a great run from 2000 to 2010 where they went to the Dixie Youth World Series every year, but I think once in that decade. And then we finally transitioned to Little League after a lot of debate with longtime board members who were just Dixie Youth through and through and just, you know, didn't want to make the jump, but we finally did it. You know, that first year, Coach Joe Keefe had the team. He won the league, took the 12-year-old team to the Southeast region. Back then, it was pool play. I think they went 1-2. They lost to Jake Fromm and Warner Robbins that year, who ended up winning the region and going to the World Series. But that was our first step into Little League. I had the 11-year-old team that year, which ended up being the 12-year-old team in 2012, which we're talking about.
Yeah.
And the 11s, you know, our whole goal that year was just to, we're new to Little League. We don't know what this is about. Let's just go see how we stack up. So that's our goal. Let's try to get to the regional in Greenville, North Carolina, actually where they're hosting the Softball World Series now. So we got there and we had a good run. Went all the way to the championship game, lost to Weddington, North Carolina. Kids were highly upset because we had the game won. It was 3-0 going into the final at bat. Their final at bat in the top of the sixth, and they scored 6 runs to go ahead 6-3, and we ended up losing 6-3. But, you know, kids were disappointed, they were upset, and I just reminded them. Yeah, I reminded them, though, what did we talk about at the very beginning? We just wanted to see how we stack up. How do y'all think we stack up? And they said, pretty good. And I said, so now we have motivation going into next year. And I said, all you guys are upset. You're disappointed that we lost, but hold on to this feeling. Just hold on to it every day and remember this day and how you feel and strive to never feel that way again. I think a lot of them did. They took it to heart. And the next year, we ended up, of course, going to the World Series. And a lot of the parents had shirts that said finish because we were 3 outs away from winning the region as 11-year-olds. This time they finished the job and we went all the way to the World Series. But it was just a magical thing. Had no idea how much of a impact it would have on us until we actually did it.
Now, do you remember playing in the district state tournaments to qualify for that Southeast Regional, which was the final stop before you made it to the Little League World Series?
Yeah, the district that year, our district hosted the state. Murfreesboro hosted the state. The district was split between us and Murfreesboro. So we played a few teams in Goodlettsville, and then everything transitioned to Murfreesboro for the rest of the district. We ended up playing South Nashville in the final game. The winner of that game was going to advance to the state, and then our runner-up was going to advance also that year because there was an uneven number of teams in the state tournament. So the host district was going to get two teams. So we ended up beating South Nashville. They played, I think, Parkwood for the other spot, beat Parkwood and advanced too. So Murfreesboro hosted the state. So it was at Barfield Park. Us and South Nashville were in it. We ended up playing South Nashville. I think it was the winner's bracket finals. I mentioned Justin Smith and Ryan Lau and them having to pitch a big game. It was that game. I said they pitched against Carnes, but actually Jake Rucker pitched against Carnes to get to that game. And it was us and South Nashville in the winner's bracket finals. And they pulled out a kid we hadn't seen before. I'd never seen him. I mean, he was on the team, but he didn't pitch in the district. They saved him for the state. He was throwing 70, 71, really good pitcher. And I think we had three hits that game and beat them 6-3 to advance. They ended up losing the next game to be eliminated. And then we ended up playing Columbia for the state title. And Columbia was just phenomenal. They had a really, really good team. Really tough game. You know, Brock was pitching. They hit a line drive back up the middle, hit him in the chest. I had to call timeout, go talk to him. He was crying. He got hit so hard, I asked him if he could finish the in and out. He said, yeah. He gutted it out, got through, took him out, brought Luke Brown in. He finished the game. And I mentioned, I think the game was 3-3 or 4-4, 5-5. It was real, real tight going into the last inning. We were visitors, and they were getting close to getting back to the top of their lineup. And I just remember standing on third and Jake Rucker's coming up with two runs on. I was like, Jake, just please hit it out of the park. Just please, just give us a lead going into this bottom of the sixth. And sure enough, he hit a home run. Up three runs. Luke Brown comes in the bottom half, shuts them down, and we win the state. Struggled. I mean, that's how good Columbia was. They were phenomenal. And then, you know, we went on to the region and faced Virginia in the first game. We had played them the year before in the 11-year-old region. Played them twice that year, beat them 4-3 and 6-5. As 11-year-olds, and then sure enough, first game of the region, who do we get? So it was another barn burner game that a kid named Cal Novak hit two-run home runs against us, and that was the four runs that they scored in the game. They beat us 4-3, so we had to win our next two pool play games to advance, which was against West Virginia and South Carolina. So we ended up winning the next game the next day. Played South Carolina on Monday to try to advance to the semifinals, was able to beat them. That's when we caught Greenville in the regions. And, you know, I mentioned this the other day about how important my dad is to me to this day and how important he was back then, too. We had a discussion the night before. They had a kid, left-handed pitcher, about 6'1", 6'2", threw about 75, 76. And I just expected them to start that guy. So we're having batting practice at Warner Robins' fields, and Greenville's on one field, we're on the other, and I've got Matt Franklin, who was one of our younger guys that was helping the team that year. He's throwing batting practice, and we've got him throwing, literally, we have a radar gun on him. He's throwing 75 every pitch, and he threw an entire batting practice to the entire team in like 98-degree heat, 75 miles an hour every pitch. Wow. Just to get him ready for that game.
Yeah.
And Dad had asked me, he said, so who are you going to start tomorrow? And I said, well, I'm going to start anybody. I don't remember who I was planning on starting, but it wasn't Brock. And he got mad. He said, no, you got to start Brock. And we got in this argument like we always do. And I'm like, fine, you know, what are we going to do when we get to 35 pitches? He said, we're going to take him out. I said, if we take him out at 35, then I'm fine with starting him in that game. And it ended up being the best decision of my life because, you know, Brock shut them down. We scored four runs right off the bat. We jumped ahead of them. By the time their big boy came in the game at the end of the game, it was already over with. And we ended up winning like 9-3. So it never was in doubt. there was no pressure on us when he came in the game. So it ended up working out good. We advanced to the finals where we had Brock and Jake available with 85 pitches each, which was perfect for us. Brock started the game, went 85 into the sixth inning, didn't give up a hit. Into the fifth inning. Then Jake Rucker came in the sixth, gave up the first hit of the game to Cody Winter, hit a low ball over shortstop. He got on first. They called for a bunt. The next batter, kid pops it up in front of home plate. Jake comes running off the mound, does a shoestring catch, catches the ball, stands up, throws the first. Cody went from first to second, thinking it was going to be a laid down bunt. We doubled him off, had two outs, and we ended up striking out the next batter. And again, that's where Dad's wisdom really helped me, because, you know, I'm calling pitches and there's always a lot of nerves when you're calling pitches. You know, you have little reports on the hitters and how you think you can get them out, but you never know. And you're always, you know, oh man, if I call this pitch and give up a hit, you know, oh, you know, yeah. It's 1-0 and they got a runner on first and there's 10,000 people there and they're all rooting for Warner Robins and it's just crazy. And, you know, we get to two strikes on him. And like I said, Dad would just sit on the bench. He wouldn't say nothing. But there were times in games when he would just speak his mind or tell me what he thought. And that was one of those moments. You know, we got to two strikes and he just came up to me and he said, throw the fastball. He's ready for it. And it for me, it was like taking all the pressure of the world off of me.
Good.
Like, oh, my God, yes. Dad said, throw a fastball. It's okay. So call fastball. He threw it high and inside. Kid swung at it, missed it. Strike three. We're on our way to the World Series. So
was that 1-0? Was that game 1-0?
1-0. Blake Osborne scored from third on a pass ball. Had two chances for him to score. The first time, I held him up, and the parents are going nuts in the stand. Send him. What are you doing? Why are you holding him up? But the ball bounced left from the catcher, and it was directly in line with us. So we couldn't see the ball. We didn't know where the ball was. Right. All we saw was the catcher turning around going after it, but we didn't know how far it had gone. So I had to hold him because that run was so important. You know, I don't know if it was the next pitch or whatever, but he threw a high fastball. Of course, Jake Rucker's batting, one of our best hitters, so they're really going after him. Threw a high pitch. He got by the catcher. This time we could see where the ball was. Blake Osborne sprints home, scores, and that ended up being the only run of the game.
Right.
It was just Warner Robins was just phenomenal. You know, I went and scouted them in their district tournament. You know, it kind of motivated me first because we're down there and we're sitting in left field at their park. There's a bunch of parents behind us and we can hear them talking. And they're like, well, who are those three guys there? Oh, this must be somebody scouting us, and which we were. And then I'm continuing to listen to them. And all the parents were like, well, I just don't know if we're going to be able to make it to Williamsport this year, da, 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 da. And I'm sitting here getting upset. I'm like, wow, they're already saying they're going to Williamsport. We're just now starting the district, and they've already punched their ticket.
Sure,
so that was a motivation. Okay, let's go to work. Let's try to beat these guys. But then their team walks out on the field, and they're playing a team from Dudley. And they score 31 runs in four innings. And, I mean, they hit about 10 home runs. And Dudley was not a bad team. Yeah, they were good. Dudley was really good. And they're just – I mean, we're in left field and they're hitting bombs over our head into the next field behind us. And I was just like, oh, my gosh, this team is incredible. So then I get up to go get a Coke and I'm walking down the third base line and they've got Leighton Pinckney and I'm watching him pitch. And I'm like, God, this kid throws like Brock Myers. I mean, he's got a gun. I said, we have our work cut out for us. So we watched the game. We drove back, had practice that night. And I remember the kids were just kind of lackadaisical. And we stopped practice and got on them and said, hey, we just came from Warner Robins. We just saw a team that's talking like they're going. And I tell you right now, we're not even close to being ready for that team. And if y'all think y'all are good enough to go, you got another thing coming because right now we're not going anywhere. So all this needs to stop. We got to get serious because we got a major task ahead of us. Another thing about that Warner Robins team. So fortunately for us, they streamed every game of their state tournament live. So we would play our game, and then I'd come home and watch their games on the internet. Leighton Pinckney started off their state tournament. His first 8 at-bats were home runs.
Yikes.
8 consecutive home runs. And the people, you know, the people that was commenting the game, they're like, my gosh, this team is ridiculous. And it wasn't just him. It was just throughout the lineup. They were just phenomenal. And Brock shut that team down, held them to zero runs, beat them 1-0. And they were scoring 15, 20 a game. I mean, they were just – that was a really, really good team. That was a great win for us. And against the, you know, the crowd. It was a pro Warner Robins crowd. So, huge, huge win.
You were talking about Brock Myers earlier when you were talking about him pitching, but he had a couple of long balls himself, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He had a phenomenal region. He had a phenomenal World Series. I think he's known more for his World Series and how he played there, where he had five consecutive home runs in every game we played. But he was just, I mean, the kid had confidence. And I mentioned that the other day about if you're going to pitch, you got to be confident. You got to believe you're the best, you know, and that as soon as somebody walks up to the plate, he might as well turn his butt around, go back to the dugout because you're out, because you're not getting a hit off of me. And that's how Brock was. And I mentioned the Warner Robins coach thinking that he was showboating because his son was Leighton Pinckney. Leighton didn't get any hits off of him. And he's pumping his fist coming off the mound because he's excited and fired up about what's going on. But the coach over there looked at it like, oh, he's trying to show us up. No, he wasn't. He was just passionate about what he was doing, and he was confident. You know, that you have to be that way to be a pitcher. You have to have a little bit of arrogance about you that you're the best. And if you don't, you're just not going to be that successful. You just got to be that way. And that's the way Brock was. And he, like I said, when he was 10 years old, he was a substitute on the All-Star team. Yeah. That 10-year-old All-Star team was third in the Duke Youth World Series. And Brock got one inning at bat and one inning in the defense. And that was it.
Came around, didn't
he? Yeah. 2 years later, he's the star of the team. But it just shows, just because you don't make All-Stars at 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 doesn't mean you're not going to make it 11, 12. You just got to keep working.
Of course.
Keep working, keep working, and get better and stay motivated and use that as motivation. And you'll eventually get there. And that's the way Brock was. He didn't let it get him down. You know, parents were upset about him not getting to play as a 10-year-old because, you know, there's always parents complaining about playing time. Well, we had parents, parents in 2012 complained about the same thing. Well, they were going to Brock Myers and them's parents complaining, and they're like, we don't want to hear it. Because 2 years ago, guess what? That was us. You didn't hear us complaining about it. So we don't want to hear none of that. You know, you just bide your time and keep working hard, and eventually you'll get there. But you just got to stay at it. You can't just give up because you don't make it 1 year when you think you did. I mean, it's like Michael Jordan crap. Yeah. You know, you hear that story all the time. He didn't make it as a sophomore, and now he's the greatest ever. So,
of course. Well, now look, when you win the regional, do you get to come home for a few days, or how does that work to get to the Little League World Series in Williamsport?
It's different today than it was in 2012. You played your semifinal games on Wednesday, and your championship games on Friday, and you leave for Williamsport Saturday morning. So Jen Coben told us back then. She said, whoever wins this tournament, just want you to know now there will be a bus waiting for you at the hotel 10 o'clock Saturday morning. You better be on that bus at 10 o'clock because if it's 10:01 and you're not on the bus is gone and you're out of luck. So we end up winning the tournament the next morning. Sure enough, there's a bus down there. We all jumped on the bus. They drove us from Warner Robins to Atlanta where we got on the plane and flew to Newark, New Jersey, where another bus picked us up and drove us 3 hours to Williamsport. And that's how you get there. But nowadays, the tournament ends on Wednesday. So you have Thursday, Friday of break time, and then you leave Saturday morning from Nashville. So that's what we did in 2016. So the kids came home Thursday, Friday, went to school, and then we left Saturday morning for Williamsport. We had Coach Corbin come by that year, and he came and we had a swim party Friday night, and he came and talked to the kids like he always does and to send them off. And then he, of course, flew up there and watched the team again, too. So he's always been a good supporter of the league, and we really appreciate that from him. But, yeah, it's a little different now than it used to be.
A couple of times I've had a chance to interview Charlie Mitchell and John Mitchell, former major league players, another stalwart guys in our National Old Timers Baseball Association. And the question I always was curious about that they answered for me, what is it like standing on the mound in a major league ballpark? And, of course, the awe that they express. What's it like when you see Williamsport?
You know, the whole trip there that first year, like I said, you know, 10 a.m., we're on a bus to Atlanta. We get off the bus. We go through the the airport. And that's when we realized how big a deal it was. Because like I said, it was our second year in Little League. We'd never done it before. We'd always heard if you ever made it to the World Series, it would be, you know, change. It'd be pretty much, it'd change everything. The city, the team, the league, the exposure you get. But you don't really know until you experience it. But we're going through the airport. And there's people coming up to us and know us by name. And they're hollering, Brock Myers, Brock, great game last night. You're the man. You know, and you get standing ovation going on the airplane. And it was just, that's when I started to realize, hey, this is a big deal. So, you know, we get to Newark and the bus isn't there. You know, we weren't really told what to do. Just you're going to fly to Newark and then you're going to go from Newark to Williamsport. And I didn't really have any direction. So we get our bags and I'm looking out for buses and I don't see anything. So we're there for like 3 hours waiting on the bus to come pick us up. So finally the Southeast bus shows up. We get on it. We drive in to Williamsport and we get there about 9 o'clock that night. So it took us from 10 a.m. to 9 o'clock to get to Williamsport that Saturday. But, you know, we come off the bus, you know, they check everybody, check their temperature, make sure nobody's sick. You know, they had a big issue with that this past year where a kid got sick and then it ended up spreading to everybody, almost everybody in the Grove. But if you're sick, they quarantine you in a separate room until you get over it. So that doesn't happen. So we come off the bus and there's single file leading us to our room in the Grove. Like I said, I felt like a kid, you know, when you go on vacations or trips. Like I said, following my dad's teams all those years, all those state tournaments and Dixie Youth and the Dixie Youth World Series and stuff. You know, as a kid, the first thing you do when you get to the hotel is go see what the swimming pool looks like. So that's kind of the way I felt about Williamsport. You know, we get there, we go in, we drop our bags. I immediately turn around and walk out the top entrance, which is up there, which is on top of the hill looking down at Lomity. And I'm just standing on the hill staring at it. And they got the infield lights shining down on the infield. And it's 9:30 at night. And I got this big smile on my face. And all the security people are just cracking jokes, laughing and stuff. And I'm like, guys, y'all just don't understand. I've seen this place on TV so many times. Yeah. And now I'm seeing it in person. It's like it's not real. It's just unbelievable. And the hill is so big. You just don't realize how big that hill is until you're there and see how steep it is. It's just amazing. The place is just gigantic. I mean, if you've never been there in person, you got to go. Because it's just worth the trip.
Bucket list. No kidding.
Yeah, it's so well worth it. But my center fielder was Jason Brown. So they're doing maintenance on the field one night. And I'm like, Jason, come with me. So we went down to Lomity. I went over to the gate and I asked one of the maintenance guys, do you mind me letting my center fielder go out on the field? I just want to get a picture for his parents. And they said, sure. So he went out and stood in center field and turned towards the wall. And I went over to where the bust is, the head out there in center field, and was standing in front of it. And I took a picture of Jason. It's just like your entire view from center field is the stadium. It takes up your entire peripheral vision. It's just amazing. Amazing sight. And you know, when you add 20,000 people, 30,000 people in that stadium, it's just an awe-inspiring for an 11 and 12 year old kid to experience. And for those kids to be able to be on that field in that environment, it's got to be the most incredible experience you could ever have. I mean, like I said, we were coaches, we're in the dugouts and we're looking out and we can see the outfield, all the people up on the hill and all of that, and it's amazing. But to be on that field and to be looking back at that stadium and seeing it, you know, completely cover your entire field of vision like you're in an IMAX theater, and it's nothing but people. It's just an amazing, amazing sight. And of course, if you're on the pitcher's mound, it's got to be even more. I never really looked around. You know, you go up there for mound visits, you're more looking at the player and your view is more towards the outfield. So you're not turning around looking and seeing what he sees. But it's just an amazing, amazing experience. And just fortunate. We're just so glad that we were able to make it, you know, two times and experience it, because the second time around was just as wonderful as the first. I mean, it's like Christmas.
Let's talk about some of these players, and then we'll get back to the tournament itself. But I want to go through some of these players, and if you have a little something to say about them. Of course, you had two coaches, Hale, your dad, and Steve Snyder. Mm-hmm. course, yeah. You talked about your dad and what an influence he was on you. You had a perspective of the game, it sounds like. Yeah. So, Steve Snyder, what about Steve Snyder?
Steve was wonderful. Like I said, he won the league that year. He had the Cardinals. He had come to me the year before. You know, me and Dad had the 11-year-old team. The joke with the parents was that we were helping Steve win the championship because three of the kids we were working with pitching were his players, Brock Myers, Blake Osborne, and his son, Andrew.
Yeah.
So Steve came up to me and said, "Hey, I understand. I appreciate all the work you're doing with these kids. I know pretty much I'm probably going to have the team to win the league next year because of all the work y'all are doing for my, you know, with my players. I just want you to know if I happen to win the league, I want you guys to coach the team. I just want to help."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Yeah, that'd be great. You know, we can definitely do this together." And so he ended up winning the league. He pitched Brock against us four times, and he beat us all four times.
No,
and we ended up losing the league by two games that year. And but he held true. He gave the team to us, and we went on our journey. And, you know, people asked him up in Williamsport and other places if he regretted that decision of not taking the team. And he said, "Nope, I had the best seat in the house," because he was there with his son. You know, he got to be in every meeting, everything that the local fan doesn't get to experience. There's more to it than just going to the games. There's a whole lot of things that happen behind the scenes, and he was there for all of it. He said, "I had the best seat in the house." And he said, "Honestly, if I'd had the team, I would have messed it up."
Oh,
you know, that's just the way he felt. Steve was great. He was wonderful. I mean, I loved him to death. He really, like I said, when we got off the bus in Atlanta, the kids just took off going in the airport, and he's getting off the bus hollering at them, guys, come back, like a big sheepdog trying to corral everybody. Yeah. So he kept everybody together, and he was just really good at that. He had a real good sense of humor, so nothing really bothered him. And he, you know, when everything's been going bad, and, you know, he was just basically like, you know, "Hey, it's all right. You're doing your job. You're doing it the way you're supposed to be doing it. Keep doing it. Don't worry about all that other stuff." And he kept everything even keel. And when things felt like they were going to blow up, he was the one to kind of defuse it and keep everything right. So, yeah, really, really appreciated Steve, and hate that he passed away a couple of years from COVID. Just a good guy, and he's just gone way too soon.
I'm sure. All right, let's get into the players. Luke Brown, and I think you said Lorenzo Butler played for you during the season.
Yeah, they both played for me. Luke, just, I can still shake my head when I think about him because he just drove me nuts. He, you know,
he's always won.
Yeah, and great ball player. I mean, phenomenal ball player. Ended up pitching for APSU. Great, great player, great kid, great family, but just airheaded sometimes. And, you know, he made a mistake base running. He was one of those guys that was station to station, you know, first to second, second to third, but not reading the field and saying, "Ooh, that ball got away. I think I can take the next base." He was just next, you know, that's just the way Luke was. He just wasn't instinctive like some of them. You know, we're in the regular season. He gets to third base, less than two outs. I mean, yeah, it's like one or no outs or one out, something like that. So I told him, I said, "Luke, ball hitting the air. I want your foot on the bag, looking home. Do not watch the ball. I'll let you know when to go." He said, "Got it." Sure enough, ball's hitting the air. Phew, he's gone. I'm screaming at him, "Luke, you got to come back." So he comes back, tags up. By then, the ball's in. He doesn't score. So I always take my regular season team on a baseball trip at the end of the year. Well, that particular year, we went to St. Louis for a couple of days, and we caught a St. Louis Cardinals game. So their pitcher came up to hit, and he gets on base, and he works his way around to third. So I figured it was a perfect opportunity to go talk to Luke about base running. So I got behind him. I whispered and put my hands on his shoulder and kind of leaned up and was talking in his ear. And I said, "All right, what do you think that guy's going to do if the ball's hit in the air?" "So he's going to tag up." I said, "Exactly." Yeah. Well, sure enough, they hit a ball in the air. And what does the pitcher do? Halfway down the base path. Oh, my God, I forgot I'm supposed to be tagging up. Turns around, runs back. By the time he gets to third, the ball's in. And the entire stadium is booing this guy relentlessly. And I was like, "Well, so much for that teaching experience." Yeah. That didn't work out too good. Yeah. So we get to the World Series. Luke makes it to third base. And it's against Texas in the winner's bracket finals. And same speech, ball in the air. Put on the bag, look home. If they catch it, you're going to score. If they miss it, you can crawl home. We're going to get there. Got it. Okay. Ball's hit the right field. There he goes, taking off again. Oh, he throws his hands up just like the pitcher from St. Louis, turns around, runs to the bag. I'm throwing my hands up, doing cartwheels. We're both animated as all get out. By then, the right fielder gets it to the second baseman. Well, by then, Luke has finally made it back to third. Well, for some reason, he decides, I got to go. So he takes off home. Well, the guy's got the ball at second base. He's like, oh, well, look at this guy. He's going home. Let me just lob it to my catcher, and we'll double them all. Double play, we're out of the inning. I'm like, oh, my gosh, Luke Brown. Yeah, that was Luke Brown. Yeah, but great,
described him well.
Great third baseman, great pitcher. Got the last out in the championship game against Petaluma to win the U.S. championship. Love that kid to this day. Right. But, whew.
All right, how about Lorenzo Butler?
Lorenzo, to me, is the best infielder I've ever had to this day. He just – from day one, when he got on our team, just phenomenal hands. Nothing scared that kid. He was just amazing. He ended up playing shortstop for me for 2 years. He ended up being the starting second baseman on the All-Star team as a 12-year-old. Jake Rucker had the better arms, so Jake played short. Lorenzo played second. He was just, I mean, Lorenzo was ridiculous. The kid was blazing fast. I remember I mentioned Matt Franklin threw batting practice for that team, 75 miles an hour in blazing heat to get us ready for Greenville. Well, Matt goes down to, he's down there in the Southeast region and, he's in his 20s. So the kids kind of looked at him as an older brother, and Lorenzo's messing with him, grabs his hat, starts running. So Matt's a fast guy. He's like, yeah, I'm going to chase him down, get my hat back. He chases him from the stadium all the way out past right field, heading towards center field. And he still hadn't caught him. And finally, Matt just gave up and came back. That's how fast Lorenzo was. And even another story just comes to mind. We're playing California. I don't remember if it was the first time or the second time, but they hit a ball between first and second. We're in the first base dugout. So we're, their third base coach is right there in front of us. And as soon as the ball's hit, it's sharply hit ball in the gap. The guy throws his hands up, pumping his fist. But right as he starts to pump his fist, he freezes. And he's watching what's going on. Well, Lorenzo has moved away from the ball to his left. So he's gone out into the outfield to give himself a little bit more time to get to the ball, dives on the ground, fields the ball, sitting on his rear end, throws the ball to first to Seth Marlin for the out. The coach went from celebrating to turning around at us, throwing his hands up in the air, and looks at us and said, the guy said, you might as well take your first baseman off the field because your doggone second baseman covers all of it. And we was like, that's why he's there. I mean, because he's that good. But yeah, Lorenzo was just phenomenal. I mean, he had a great tournament too. You know, the championship game against Petaluma. He had the three-run home runs for 9 RBIs. I think that's a Little League World Series record still. But it was just, I mean, just a phenomenal athlete. That kid was something else. Shame he got injured in high school and wasn't able to play anymore. Ended up going to Hillwood for high school and was their starting shortstop as like a sophomore and batted third or fourth in their lineup. Remember going to watch him in the district against Overton. Really, really good player. Just hate that he got cut short like that.
Oh, of course. What about Jason Brown?
Center fielder, really fast. Him and Lorenzo were the two fastest players on the team. Tall and lanky, covered a lot of ground in the outfield. Just, couldn't ask for a better center fielder. Batted second in the lineup. Really, really good hitter for us. Dad, Kip Brown's coach at Beach High School today. Jason ended up going to college and playing small-time college basketball. Once he finished there, he came back, and now he's coaching one of the middle school teams in the Hendersonville area. So he's a coach in basketball now. Just a great, great ball player. And a really good number two hitter, I tell you. We had a real good hitting team, and he was one of the reasons why. Just a really good ball player.
Let's say Cole Carter.
Catcher, tough as nails. I mean, when we have pitching practice, catchers catch the pitchers. The coaches don't catch because the catchers need to work. You know, you got Brock Myers throwing 74, 75, and he puts one in the dirt. Well, Cole's job isn't to throw his glove at it. It's to slide his body and get in front of it and block it and keep it towards home plate. He'd take a ball off that arm, that forearm, and I know it hurts. And I'm like, you're all right? You need time? No, I'm good. Let's go. And that's just how Cole was. He was just tough as nails. You got to be a different type of person to be able to, or to even want to catch. I mean, I think you're insane if you want to catch, because that position is tough. I mean, you take some shots if you're going to catch. And for anybody to want to get down there and do it the right way, you're just a different type of person. I mean, because not everybody is built for it. And Cole Carter was built for it. He was just really, really good catcher, caught pretty much every inning of every game all the way through. His poor legs were wore out in the end because he caught so many innings. But I mean, he was invaluable to the team because hardly anything ever got by him. He ended up batting over 500 in the World Series, was fifth in the lineup. You know, he was one of those kids when you're standing on third, he comes up to the plate, you know something good's going to happen. You just know. You know, you're not worried about the pitcher. Cole's going to hit this guy. That's just how you felt. And that's the kind of player he was. He was just phenomenal.
Right. Ryan Lyle was your other pitcher, I think.
Yeah, Ryan was the biggest player on the team. He was 5'8", 5'9", had a 68-mile-an-hour fastball that year. You know, he broke the ice for us. You know, when you get up there, and we talked about this earlier about the view from the field, it's awe-inspiring. And most of these kids hadn't played in front of more than 100 people. You know, the park is packed when you got 100 people standing around the field. Now you got 25, 30,000 people there. And we were the primetime game that Thursday night. And we're playing, you know, the team from Kearney, Nebraska. And we're struggling. We're not hitting. We're not doing anything. And Ryan bats seventh or eighth in the lineup, somewhere around in there. And he comes up, hits a home run for the first home run in Goodlettsville history in the Little League World Series. And after that home run, it just broke the ice. And we ended up winning, I think, 12-1 or something like that.
12-1. That's right.
Yeah. Just smoked them. But it was because of Ryan. Ryan broke the ice. He went out there and got the job done, and everybody else was able to relax and play. And it really does take the kids a few games to kind of acclimate to the atmosphere, because you really don't know what to expect. I remember that first year, we had just come from Warner Robins. We had 10,000 people rooting against us. Yeah. And I mean, literally rooting against us. They were pounding. You know, the stands were above the dugout, so you can hear them pounding their feet on the ground and the rumble like thunder above you. And you're walking up to hit, and they're hollering swing and all kinds of things to distract you. So, you know, we're expecting the same type of thing in Warner Robins. And then we get our first hit and the crowd erupts. And we're like, oh, hey, this is kind of nice. These people aren't here to root against you. They just want to see good baseball.
Yeah.
So it was just a different environment. And it was really, really nice to hear the crowd cheer for you instead of against you like that. And like I said, Ryan hit the big home run, and it just opened the floodgates for us. And after that, we were fine.
Yeah. Seth Marlin was an infielder.
Yeah. Backup first baseman that year. He played second base the year before as an 11-year-old. Great kid. I mean, he was the smallest player on the team. He's 6'2" now, so he's really grown. He was a really good pitcher that year for his regular season team. I said I lost to Brock. Our team lost to Brock four times. Well, Seth beat Brock three or four times.
No,
they couldn't. They could not beat Seth. Seth beat him every time. He had a curveball, fell off the table.
Yeah.
He didn't have a lightning fastball because he was just so much smaller than everybody else. But just really, really, really good pitcher. And just a good teammate. I mean, just, you know, can't say enough about him. I love that kid to death to this day. He helped me coach for a couple of years. Wasn't able to coach with me last year because he took over his dad's business. His dad retired, so he had to take over the entire Snap-on Tools route. And he's just like, I just don't have time. I go in at 7. I don't get done till like 7:30. I'm just so tired. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, really? Said, you know, then you need to have a better respect for your dad and what he did for you, because he did this and he coached you.
And he quit. Yeah, and he was
he did it. He was there. So, I mean, just really love your dad even more, because now you know what kind of commitment he gave to make sure you had the experience that you had. And I love Seth to this day. He's just a great kid, great around the kids. He was instrumental in the 2016 World Series team's run. He threw batting practice for that team. Him and his dad showed up to the Southeast region, I think, second day. And as soon as he showed up, I mean, it was like spreading like wildfire with the kids. Seth is here. Seth is here. And they just all gravitated to him. And he's just like another big brother. I mean, they just loved him to death. And he really enjoyed it, because he got to share his experience of going in 2012 with the 16 team. whenever he talked about this is what it's like, that they were just all ears. They just couldn't get enough of it. And he was a big, big reason why we had success in 16. I just, like I said, love Seth to death.
Yeah, his memories were special. And he undoubtedly expressed those pretty well. Now, Brock Myers, everybody remembers the name, I think, when you think about 2012 Little League World Series from Goodlettsville. I think that's the name everybody recognizes, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. He ESPN definitely picked him out as our best player, and he was. He was our number one pitcher, killed the baseball, batted third in the lineup. I mean, couldn't ask any more for his bat. 5 home runs in the World Series, carried us on the mound wherever we had a big game we had to win. He was the guy who was going to pitch it. He pitched against California twice. And if he doesn't pitch against California in those two games, we don't win the U.S. championship. You know, and speaking of that, you know, it just brings up another memory that Dad and I had. You know, he came into my room during the tournament. And he asked me, he said, what do you want to do? Do you want to win the U.S. championship or you want to try to win the whole thing? And I said, you know what? U.S. championship would be great. He said, good answer, because we don't have the pitching to do both. But we can't win this U.S. championship if we do it this way. And the goal was Brock pitches that U.S. championship game and he goes the whole way. Yeah. And that's exactly what we did. And when he left the mound, we was up 15-5.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they scored 10 runs after he left in that one inning to tie it at 15-15. But he got us on the threshold of winning the U.S. championship, and we was just able to survive the rest of the way. But, I mean, Brock was just a phenomenal player, good teammate. Couldn't ask for anything more from a kid. I mean, he had the best tournament you could possibly have. He comes back to this day and throws batting practice to today's all-star teams. He threw batting practice to last year's 12-year-old team to get him ready for the district. Just a great kid. You know, he's finished up his career at Tennessee Tech, and now he's back home. And just another one that I just really, I'm glad that he stayed current with the park and continues to give back, because it's guys like that that helps the league continue to have success when they come back and help out like that.
Yeah, of course. Okay, Colin O'Berry.
Colin O'Berry. He was a travel ball kid. We don't get many. We're a true rec league. Our kids start when they're 4, 5, and 6, and they pretty much go through the whole system until they're 12 and they age out. We lose kids here and there to travel, but we normally don't get many. Colin happened to be one of those kids that signed up his 12-year-old year to play. He ended up making All-Stars. I remember he stood out to me and Dad because he beat us, the team that he was playing for. He hit a home run against us to win a game. He pitched against us during the regular season, just played, had a really, really good regular season. Me and Dad both said, yeah, this kid's got to be on the team. So he made the All-Star team. He ended up being a substitute. But, you know, you have kids and, you know, and parents that complain, my kid's not playing enough. He should be playing more than this. He's better than that guy. I don't know why coach ain't playing him. They weren't that type of parents, and he wasn't that type of player. Whatever you wanted from him, he gave you his best. If he wasn't on the field, he was up against the fence cheering for his teammates. If he was on the field, he was going to do the best he could to help the team win. And that's all you can ask for in a player. And really, when you get to All-Stars, that's what you have to have. Exactly. Because if you got parents and kids that are complaining about this or that, it brings the team down because it brings in negativity. And that negativity will spread like wildfire.
Of course.
And he was just a great, great teammate. You know, and another thing I think about him, you know, if you go to the museum, there's a picture of Colin O'Berry in the museum in Williamsport. And he had these deep blue eyes. And I remember one thing I noticed about the kids, they are literally celebrities when they go to this tournament. And I'm walking behind Brock Myers and Colin. They're walking together. And they've got 2 or 3 little young girls walking with them. And I'm 20 feet behind them. There's another group of girls that pass them. And they start talking amongst themselves. Was that? That was. They all turn around. And next thing you know, instead of 2 or 3 girls with them, now they got 8 or 9 walking with them. And I tell
blue
you,
blue
the
eyes,
girls,
right?
They love Colin O'Berry. He had that look.
Yeah.
And they just flocked after Colin O'Berry. But yeah, his picture's in the, you know, it should still be there. I haven't been there in a couple of years. But last time I was there, I looked up and sure enough, there's Colin O'Berry hanging in the rafters.
Awesome.
And in the museum. It's pretty cool.
That's great. All right, Blake Osburn.
Love him to death. Savvy would be the best thing. He threw a perfect game during the regular season. Him and Brock played on the same team. He was part of what Steve Snyder was saying. Hey, I know I'm probably going to win the league with Brock and Blake and Andrew pitching. And he was right. I mean, you had Brock dominating. And then when Brock's not pitching, your other guy's throwing perfect games. I mean, it was just, they were just really, really good. He was a great pitcher for us. He pitched in the game against Japan. He mentioned just a few years ago, because he helped me coach with Seth. I had those two helping me together 1 year. He confided that, or admitted would be a better word, that when Kiyomiya came up to hit, I was throwing the ball everywhere I could to make sure he did not hit it back at me, because I did not want to get hit by him He was 5'1" and Kiyomiya was 6'205". Big kid. Yeah. And I was like, really? I didn't know that. So pretty good little thing. But yeah, he also got hit in that tournament. And that's the thing that stands out the most, because I'm rewatching the game and he got hit by pitch, umpire letting go to first, and he's over at first base rubbing his arm. So they're showing the replay and Nomar Garcia Parr and whoever was doing it with him, they're slowing the ball down as it goes by him, and it just grazes his sleeve. Yeah. But doesn't touch him at all. And he's over there rubbing his arm like, oh, my arm's hurting so bad. And Nomar and them's like, Blake, wrong spot. That didn't hit you right there. No, but he's playing it up. He's like playing he really got right. hit. So, yeah, like I said, savvy kid for 12 years old to get on base however you can. So, he came close to hitting. So he played it up and got on first. So,
All right. Now, here's one he continues to play baseball to this day, Jake Rucker.
Yeah, Jake, he was our best hitter, shortstop, number two pitcher on the team, peaked at 70 miles an hour that year. Phenomenal player. You know, ended up going to JP2, was signed by University of Tennessee, played third base for Tennessee for 3 years. And then he got drafted by the Minnesota Twins, and now he's in their AA organization this past summer. Just great ball player. He was very emotional. Remember, as an 11-year-old, I talked about Virginia, us having two tough games against them. We beat them by one run each game as 11. Well, one of those games, Jake pitched, and they scored three runs off of him in the first 20 pitches of the game. He's on the mound boo-hooing like crazy. I go up there to talk to him and calm him down a little bit, talk about it's a learning experience, just got to learn to fight through it, this, that, and the other, but we're going to take you out. We brought Brock in. And, you know, Brock wasn't the Brock Myers that everybody knows today at this point. He's still learning how to pitch. And I remember Dad saying the first day we got the team together and started working on pitching, he said, this kid isn't right now, but when we get to Greenville, North Carolina, he's going to be the best pitcher on our team. He was talking about Brock. Well, this was his coming out party against Virginia. We didn't use him in the district, didn't use him in the state. It was Luke Brown and Jake Rucker carried us through those tournaments. Andrew Snyder was another one that carried us back then, and a kid named Austin Ford, who didn't even make the team as a 12-year-old because he got hurt that year. Right. They carried us to the region. We're down 3-0, first 20 pitches of the game. Brock comes in and shuts them down the rest of the way. He goes 50 pitches. They don't score again. We come back and win the game 4-3, and all Virginia wanted to talk about was Brock Myers. Oh, my gosh. We hadn't faked. Nobody shut us down like that before. I mean, that was incredible. And that was his coming out party. But Jake was just real emotional. You know, we played Japan. He's leading off. Kiyomiya's on the mound. Like I said, he's 6'205", and he's throwing 82 miles, which is literally, you know, it's 82 times 1.3 is the translation. But it's 106 miles an hour, somewhere around there.
Big. Yeah.
And he hits a line drive between the shortstop and second base. And the shortstop for Japan just scampers over to his left, gobbles the ball up behind second base, fires a perfect strike to first, throws him out. He comes back to the dugout crying. I'm like, what are you doing? You just hit an 82-mile-an-hour fastball and killed it, and you're crying. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. But that was Jake.
That's
the way I look at it. You always got to try to put a positive spin on it, and that's what it meant. He wants to do well so bad that sometimes it gets the best of him and his emotions come out, and that's what it was. The kid just has that kind of drive to want to be the best and to want to do well, and he didn't succeed that at bat, but he ended up getting drafted by the Minnesota Twins, and nice playing double-A ball. Hopefully he'll continue to progress and move on up the chain and maybe make it to the majors one day.
Yeah, yeah. He may have that major league career ahead of him. All right, Jonathan Seals.
Switch hitter, Joey Seals' son. Joey played catcher in the Dodgers organization.
Right.
Great, great ball player. I mean, I love Jonathan. He batted ninth on the team, 500 batting average. You know, you always want that ninth batter to be pretty good, because if he can flip the lineup and get back to the top, you can have big things happen. And that's what Jonathan did for us. He was able to flip the lineup many times in tournament games, allowing Jake and Jason and Brock and those guys to come up and score runs and with two outs. And it was just huge. And that's what, you know, Jonathan was able to do. He was our backup catcher also behind Cole. We didn't have to use him much. So he started at first base for us. Just a really, really good player. Of course, his dad, you know, was a Good Pasture grad. He was a couple of years ahead of me at Good Pasture. So he was in the class that had Jeff Jarrett and Jeff Forehand.
Yeah.
And a really good class. And they all played basketball together. And that's where I first knew of Joey, because he was one of the super studs at Good Pasture back then.
He was.
And then I run into him at the ballpark, and his son's playing ball, and I get to coach his son. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Justin Smith?
His dad was our assistant chief, who really helped me out a lot that year, because he's the guy that was in charge of getting me off work at the fire department to be able to do all of that, because it takes a lot of your time. So that was, for me, real important. He missed half the season that year. He played for Greenbrier Middle School, and the Greenbrier coach wouldn't let any of his players play for any other team until their season ended. So his regular season didn't begin until his middle school season began. So we had to make sure his schedule was in his roster form. So when we got to the Southeast region and Jen Colvin was looking over everything, she saw that, yes, his season didn't start until that season ended, and he played this many games, which made him eligible, da, da, da. But I think his biggest thing, he was one of our pitchers. He helped us win state. He pitched against South Nashville, a big game, and then he pitched again in the regional, another big game after we had lost to Virginia the first game. We had a big game coming up the next day. Him and Ryan Lau pitched that game to get us a huge win to allow Jake Rucker to pitch the third one to get us into the semifinals. But during the, you know, when you qualify for the semifinals, the television game, that's when they do the lineup on ESPN where you say your name is my favorite player. And he got into his head that he was going to be British and did it in a British accent. Colin O'Berry, poor Colin's the next one in line, and he's laughing so hard he can't even do his parts. They had to redo it all over again. But that was his big thing. He got on this British accent kick. But, yeah, love the kid. He started at the beginning, but he ended up one of our subs. And another good player. Never caused problems, never complained, you know, just always did whatever he could to help the team.
Yeah. And last but not least, Andrew Snyder. Now, that's Steve Snyder's his father, correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
Andrew was our starting left fielder. You know, he pitched for us the year before. We didn't use him as a pitcher. The next year, he batted around sixth or seventh in the lineup, somewhere towards the bottom, but just a solid all-around ball player. I'm not even going to get into the story about the Southeast region thing,
right.
But Steve came to the rescue on that one about playing time and complaints, and him reminding me, you're doing everything right. Don't worry about what's being said. My son's getting the playing time he's supposed to be getting. You just keep doing what you're doing. And thanks, Steve, so much for being there in those moments, because every coach deals with it. And it's always an issue. And it does ruin the experience when you have to deal with stuff like that. And Steve was always there to kind of smooth things over. But his son, Andrew, was just a great kid. He was the big pen collector in Williamsport. He had a big book, went to all the teams and traded pens with them. And I bet he still got it to this day. Probably a huge pen collection. But, yeah, he was our big pen trader.
Yeah, shoot, that's great. Well, getting back to the Little League World Series, your first game was against Nebraska. We talked about that. You won 12-1. And two days later, you played California. You won 9-6.
Yep. Yep.
Upper final on the 22nd, you beat Texas 11-1. And then on the United States Championship, you had to face California again. And you won that game 24-16. And before we go, I'd like for you to talk about that championship game for us. Would you do that?
That was we knew it was going to be tough. I was looking forward to that game, though, because, you know, the California coach, to me, came off as being a little cocky. He it happened to us earlier in the Southeast region. We beat Warner Robins. We come across the field saying, good game, good game, good game. And their coach shakes my hand and says, the umpires beat us. Uh-oh. We didn't beat them. The umpires beat them. I'm like, yeah. What? Yeah. I look back now and I'm like, they were just so upset that they didn't win because it's such a big deal to make it that far. And we didn't know any better. We didn't know what we was going into in Williamsport. You know, we do now, but we didn't then. So we were just new to the thing. So we play California, and all the big plays in that game was on their side. They hit all the home runs. I mean, Brock hit a home run for us, but all the big plays were them. But we ended up winning 9-6. And so we come across the field. Their coach shakes my hand and says, we'll see you on Thursday. And what he meant was we just beat them, so we get 2 days off. We got Monday, Tuesday off. We was going to play Texas on Wednesday. The winner would advance to the championship game. The loser would play the next day on Thursday against the loser's bracket winner, which he said was going to be them. We're not losing again. We'll see you Thursday because you're not going to beat Texas. And I was like, oh, okay, really? So I just use that as motivation for the kids. You know, they don't think we're going to win. What do y'all think? Let's go play. Yeah. And we ended up, you know, pulling that game out against Texas. That was a tough, tough game for us. We got fortunate. They threw a ball in the right field trying to get Jason Brown out at first base. He ended up rounding the bases and ended up scoring and gave us enough runs to win that game to get to the championship game. So, you know, we play them, Petaluma, in the U.S. bracket finals. And, you know, they were basically saying we only beat them because they didn't have their best pitching on the mound the first time. And now they do, so it's going to be different. So they had the big kid. He was 6'4", pitching for them. Like I said, you know, I mentioned about Cole Carter. You're standing on third base. Cole walks up to the plate. You just know Cole's going to get a hit. I felt that way about a lot of these kids. Jake Rucker, I didn't care who you had. He's going to hit the ball. He's just that good. I mean, we led the World Series in batting average that year. We had a .420 batting average going into the game against Japan and ended up .380 after – getting mowed down by Kiyomiya. Yeah. We didn't get many hits off of him, so our average suffered, but we still led the tournament with a .380 average, and the next best was Mexico at .320. But I just wasn't nervous or anything about that game because I just knew how good a team we had. And the other thing is going back to my dad. You know, he always said when he coached in all those Dick Youth World Series games, he never was nervous because he knew he was there. There wasn't another tournament to win after that one. There was no more tournaments to go to because the hard part was getting there. Now that you're there, the pressure's off. Yeah. So I just took that to heart. So whenever I've had the good fortune of being with a team that made it that far, I just like, hey, this is house money. Let's just go play and have fun and see what happens. So we're just playing the game. And like I said, we had a great lineup. I love, you know, didn't think Jake could not hit anybody. Same thing about Jason Brown, Brock Myers, Cole Carter, Lorenzo, all those guys. I just felt real confident in them. I think that kid lasted maybe 2 or 3 innings and he was out of the game. I mean, we were just pounding them. And, you know, we were pretty much controlled that game all the way to the 6th inning, up 15-5, ran out of pitches at the end of the 5th inning, I think, or maybe the first batter in the 6th. I think the big 6'4" kid got a double off of him to get him to 85. It was a pretty smooth, easy game all the way up until that point. And then, you know, we took Brock out. I think we brought Ryan Lau in the game. Like I said, he threw 68 miles an hour. And it was just everything changed. I mean, Petaluma started swinging the bat, couldn't get him out, hit after hit after hit, home run after home run. Clean hit after clean hit. I mean, that team was just phenomenal. They had such a good hitting team. You know, they ended up scoring 10 runs to tie the game. The final out was a ball into right center field where Jason Brown made the catch, but Brock Myers almost ran into him. He just ran barely behind him. But if they collide and that ball hits the ground, we lose right there. Uh-huh. And that would have been devastating to be up 10 runs in the 6th inning and lose. You know, I remember thinking, if we lose this game, I'll never be able to go home. I mean, I won't be able to go home. I mean, it'll be that devastating. But we got the final out. We come into the dugout, and the kids are down. They got their heads down. I've got my head down. I'm like a deer in headlights. I don't know what's going on. I'm shocked at what just happened. And, you know, again, luckily, I've got my dad there. And he's been there, done that. all the experience in the world. And like I said, he stayed quiet all, you know, throughout all those games, never really said much until I think he felt like he needed to say something. Like, now's the time I need to step in. And he stepped in. We had the break between innings to where when you're on ESPN, you don't immediately at the change of the inning run out on defense, start warming up. They hold you in your dugout for 45 seconds to a minute while they do commercials. And then they let you go out. And that by the time you get your pitches in, they're coming out of commercial break and the game resumes. So we had that little break. And Dad took it upon himself. He gathered the kids. He got their attention. He's just stood up, started screaming. He said, pointed across the field at the other side, said, "Look at those guys. They think this game's over. They're over there doing cartwheels. Yeah. I can't believe," and I just da-da-da-da-da, just going on and on and on. And our focus went from heads down to now we're looking and seeing how those kids on the other side of the field are acting. And the kids went from upset and down to up and just now another type of upset, angry upset. And, yeah, oh my gosh, I can't wait to get in that batter's box. Let me at them. So Jake Rucker comes in. He's leading off the inning. He gets a hit. We get another hit. We get another hit. Home run here. Next thing you know, we got three or four runs. And I'm like, oh, thank gosh. I think we can hold them off. And then by the time the inning was over, we had nine. And we're up 24 to 15. Mm-hmm. So this time it's their time to come off the field. And they're doing it. They look exactly like us. Their heads are down. I'm looking over at their coaches, and their heads are down just like mine was. They have no idea what to say. Yeah. And it was
they
just
didn't
like
have your dad, did they?
They didn't have my dad. It was a tomb over there. It was quiet. They were shell shocked at what had just happened. We just scored 10 runs to tie this game up, and then they turn around and score 9. Yeah. I mean, oh my gosh! Yeah. And their coaches had nothing for them. And Luke Brown comes in, he wraps the game up, he strikes out the big kid to end the game. We end up giving up one run, 124-16. I remember talking to Chris Massey, who's one of the writers for the Williamsport Gazette afterwards, and he said, "Man, I've been here for doing this for a long time. And I have to tell you, that was the greatest game I have ever witnessed in this stadium, that game right there." It ended up being voted as the greatest game of all time. Set a record for runs scored, 40 between the two teams. We had 26 hits in that game, and I think the record is 29 from a team from Taiwan. I mean, just think, 26 hits in 7 innings. That's a lot of hits against good pitching. Yeah. Everybody was throwing 68, 69. I remember Nomar saying in the telecast, "These pitchers just don't have anything for these hitters." I mean, it's like throwing soft toss to these guys. They're just hitting the ball that well. And both those teams were just, you know, our team and theirs too, was just really, really good hitting teams. And they put on a show. I mean, both those teams put on a show. And to be able to do it in front of a crowd like that is what is really amazing. I mean, you forget you're not at Moss Wright Park in front of 70 people. You're at Lomedy Stadium in front of 25,000-30,000 on a national, worldwide television audience. I mean, that is a huge stage to perform like that. I mean, it was just an amazing game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was terrible when it was going on. It was miserable to suffer through that sixth inning like that. But now when you look back on it, you're like, man, that was one of the best experiences ever to be able to go through that.
Part of the process. You know, that was an historic game. But I think that whole series with Goodlettsville Little League in the Little League World Series was historic. I want to thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to Joy Hale and I talk about Goodlettsville Little League's march to the United States Championship for the Little League World Series in 2012. Now, just to recap, his first game for the Southeast Little League team was on August the 17th of 2012 versus Nebraska, and they won 12-1. And 2 days later, on the 19th, they beat California 9-6. And then in the upper bracket final on the 22nd versus Texas, they won 11-1. Then on August the 25th, 2012, the United States Championship versus California, they won 24-16. And Joey went into great detail about that. And I am grateful to Joey for coming on with me. And I hope you've enjoyed listening to him. And until next time, this is Skip Nipper